This episode is sponsored by Foudies.com, the only official retail store dedicated to women's football merch. Helen Hardy is a football entrepreneur. She is the founder of the Alternative Football League, an award-winning inclusive league for all women, trans and non-binary people. She is also the founder of Foudies.com, the only official retail store dedicated to women's football merch. So let's start at the beginning. Where did your love of football come from?
So I come from Newcastle upon Tyne. It's a football city. Football is religion. My granddad was a big Newcastle United fan. Jackie Milburn was an iconic player for Newcastle United back when he was a lad, and we were pretty good back then, believe it or not. And and so he obviously raised my dad as a Newcastle United fan, and then my dad, his three girls, so me and my two big sisters, to be Newcastle United fans. And I think since I've left Newcastle growing up, I didn't quite realise how unique Newcastle is as a football city. And the North East in general, I think Newcastle fans would be annoyed me saying this, but Sunderland and Middlesbrough obviously tied into that. It really does drive like the joy of the city. If your team are doing well, you see it in the infrastructure of the city, you see the city buzzes. Newcastle's unique in the sense as well, like in the centre, the heart of the city, the stadium sits on a hill. So it's literally at every point of the city that you're in, if you're on, you know, on the main street, shopping street, or whether you're down by the quayside, you can see the stadium sat there up on the hill. And my first ever game was Newcastle United 5, Manchester United 0. Alan Shearer was quite a new player back then, like he just started with the club. He was famous for Philippe Albert, like, chipping the goalkeeper from outside the area. It was like an iconic moment for the club, and it happened to be my entry point into football. So I just fell in love. I think people of my age, I'm 32, it's that generation that experienced Euro 96 and then straight into the World Cup in 98. So it was a big football time. It was like people's earliest memories being that. I kind of feel sorry for kids that were, where their earliest memories are, say, like Wayne Rooney, you know, Iceland game or whatever. My earliest memories were like this iconic Gaza period, you know, Alan Shearer, these Northeast lads absolutely bossing it on the world stage. So absolutely fell in love.
Did you fall in love with playing football? Did you get the opportunity to play football as a kid? And when did you start playing?
Well, I think there's, for everybody, when you're little, there's always that crossover. And that is genderless, as it were. So you don't understand gender when you're a little girl or a little boy. So, and I think that works both ways. So when I was at primary school, I'd play with the little boys, and I don't think they were realising, and I was realising what that really meant. Or yeah.
There's also not a big there's no physical difference
zero.
Until either the end of primary or heading into secondary. There's actually a bit of time where the girls are towering over the boys.
There was zero ability difference. There really was. It was only adults that were implementing the change. Yeah. It was adults that were saying, like, do you want to play with these dollies or whatever? It was never my parents. It was always outside people looking in that had judgment on it. And that's what's so sad about this world that we live in, is that kids are so non-judgmental. It's adults that implement that. It's adults that make that change happen. And so I remember playing with the little lads, and I remember my dad taking me, it's actually a funny story that goes with this. In 1996, 97, my dad used to take me to this place called Forest Hall, which was outside Newcastle. He would drive me like half an hour to the only girls club. And it was like 7 and 8 year olds and like 13, 14 year old girls. It was like, no, there was no like middle ground like there is today. It was like all of you plonked together. There may be 15 of you on a pitch, and then a couple of like cones and off you go. And I remember we played our first ever game against Sunderland. You might have heard of them. And I spoke to Jill Scott recently, who I said, Jill, I think in about 1997, 98, we played you as my first ever fixture and you battered us 26-0. She went, oh, I remembered that. Yous were rubbish. Like, we were having a real laugh about it. But that was just showed you. It was like Sunderland had no one to play at that level, where that was the cream of the crop. And we had no one to play. So somehow, you know, you ended up with Forest Hall Girls Club playing Sunderland, who were, you know, going into Elite England Academy, playing each other. You know, I played against Jill Scott, got absolutely battered, mind. But you're playing against sort of these players, and that was the 90s.
Yeah.
Like, there was like 50 of us in the Northeast wanting to play football or having access to football, and that was the outcome.
In an ideal world, when do you think it makes sense to split boys and girls? Do you think there's a point where it makes sense?
I think in today's world, there should be just the option. There should be just the want to have both. What I will say is there's tons of studies around it. And again, this goes back to humans imparting this onto people. This isn't just like how you're born. So boys aren't just born to like football or born to be really good with coordination. And girls aren't born to like dollies and be really good at other stuff. It's been implemented by adults. I think there's a great thing about having girls and boys co-ed football sessions growing up for as long as you possibly can. But then I also think there's a really good or positive way of having girls on their own to grow in that confidence and to give them, you know, those key skills at this stage that we're at as a society, where even at the age of 5 or 6, boys will be more ballsy and force their way in. I was at the Man City Academy about 2 weeks ago, at this sort of, there was this event where Calvin Phillips was coming to meet these kids. And so it was a mixed gender summer holiday camp where I'd say 80% boys, 20% girls, and I'd say age range of like 3 or 4 years in between, so maybe 8 to like 11, 12. And just I saw the girls like sort of going off into the shadows.
Yeah, shrink away.
Shrinking away. Like, you'd see the lads dancing through the midfield and not caring when they messed up. And then you'd see the girl mess up once and she maybe step off and have a cry and want to come back in. And that's not been come from birth. That's not to do with women's brains or the way that they're set. That's to do with society imparting that. That's parents and teachers and people from the outside imparting that. So I think we'll see the change over the years in football, where girls would be like, nah, this is my space too.
Yeah.
But I actually think that comes with time. My little niece is in an all-girls, she's 7, she's in all-girls sessions, and I'm really glad. Like, that was my advice to my cousin about putting her into those sessions, because I felt like she needed to be, you know, the queen of that session. I wanted her to have that confidence and grow in that confidence. But that's not to say that she wouldn't be able to stand toe-to-toe against any lad of her age.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I think it's a confidence issue, isn't it? That starts somewhere. And of course, that's going to start when you're 6, 7, 8.
Yeah.
And I think there's more pressure on girls as well not to try and be creative on the pitch, or not to try new things, like for fear of messing up and for fear of what the boys might say to them, or for fear of, like, if you're the only girl on a team, you don't want to mess up.
For sure.
Like, there's more pressure on you.
It just really frustrates me, and I keep on sort of like hammering home the point that comes across in the world as if that's just how we're born.
Yeah.
Like, we're born to be, I want to say in inverted commas, and we're on a podcast, but weak.
Yeah.
And that's not the fact. That's not the reality. The reality is that we're told, it's hammered home from such an early age, that we're lesser than.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't try as hard. But then in the other sense, I play for an adult men's team. I just really get on with the lads, and it's over in Liverpool, and I like to go over there and have a kick about, and occasionally play 11-a-side, but mainly 5-a-side. Mm-hmm. I really like the physical challenge. My God, they never pass.
Yeah.
And I play 11-a-side women's team, and I run Manchester Laces, we're an inclusive women's space.
Mm-hmm.
And we're really good at passing.
Yeah.
So like in terms of if we went toe-to-toe, I think on 5-a-side, you know, the 5-a-side Manchester Laces team and the 5-a-side Rover and Out team, I think what we'd see is a difference in agility from the women's perspective.
Yeah.
We're amateur players, all of us, you know, we'll go for a beer or whatever. I'm not talking elite level. We'd see agility, passing, nuanced sort of play from the women's players. And you'd see a couple of these lads just thinking that they're, you know, Lionel Messi trying to dance through the midfield. I mean, it's just like the togetherness of women's football is, you know, I'm coming back full circle here because we're talking about the early days in the 90s and growing up and little kids. But the differences that you see when you run an 11-a-side women's team in an inclusive environment, where that's the intention that we've launched as a women's team versus a women's team that's been launched as a mirror image of a men's team. So they've added on a women's team on the side. It's totally different, totally different, because when you've got a men's team that's launching a women's team, you're taking that lad culture and all of that stuff over. With us, it's genuine togetherness. Mm-hmm. It's like genuine wanting to create really good football, a really good environment, a really kind environment. And that comes from womanhood, as it were. Like, and I think that's really, really special.
Yeah.
But yeah, for sure, I think to go back to your initial point, I think it's good to separate girls and boys and have those separate sessions. I also think it's really good to have them together. I think they can learn from each other. And then I think that in the future, it won't matter, because I think that we hope and I pray that as a society, we start to see that, you know, girls can do anything that boys can do. I sound really cliched and a bit like basic saying that, but that's just the reality, isn't it?
Yeah, just moving beyond that
boundary. Yeah, beyond that, it's just irrelevant.
Yeah, definitely. So I think I read somewhere, I heard on one of your previous podcasts, that there was an age where you had to stop playing because there just wasn't the teams available. What kind of age was that, and when did you pick it up again?
So I stopped playing football in the Northeast, I would say, for various reasons, at age sort of 12, 13. I think now, looking back, probably there was a big societal thing. It wasn't offered in my school. Newcastle United Foundation at the time, we weren't under Mike Ashley, so there was money pumped into the community. Had to get that in there. But under the previous ownership, who was owned by a local Newcastle chairman, we would have school trips to Newcastle United. However, ironically, it just wasn't offered in our school for girls, even though we had that connection to the club. So it was just cut off. You didn't play with the boys anymore. There was that outside pressure. I loved it. I would play in the park occasionally. I would play on my own a lot in my garden. I had like a big brick wall, so I would assist myself.
Yeah.
And then I took it back up when I moved down to London. I took it back up at like age 18, 19. So there was a huge gap there, a huge gap of like a real time of development in terms of football, where you're moving through puberty and you're growing in strength. And I didn't have a sport. It's like the girls will be inside an indoor, you know, area, because maybe back then it was that their nuanced thinking was they'll feel safer or whatever. Yeah. But there's so much pressure from the outside on how you looked as a woman that it was like it almost the other side of thinking would be, are you hiding us away?
Yeah.
So like it would be like, we'll make them feel, we'll put them in the hall and then, you know, we'll shut all the curtains and no one will see them. But actually I always felt a bit like, I want to be outside on the field.
Yeah.
Like, I want to be covered in mud. And that's always how I felt.
Well, we'll come on to talk about the Euros in a minute, because I think that will have changed things massively for kids who are at school now. But you said you picked football up again when you moved down to London.
Yeah.
Was that a uni team?
Yeah, so initially... it was through university, but it was a kind of community mixture. So it would be like the uni students. That was what it was like in 08. You wouldn't really have like uni football clubs. It was starting to come in.
Right, okay.
For like every 10 men's teams, there might be a women's team, potentially. But it was like, so there'd be like 45-year-old women and then, you know, 18-year-olds.
Right, okay.
And then I also like, I happened to go to drama school. So I actually was banned halfway through the term, because I went to one of those drama schools where it was quite like serious, and then the teachers sort of got wind of the fact I was playing football and they were worried about injury through ballet and jazz and stuff like that. And by no stretch was I a dancer, by the way, just to really clarify, and I'm at home, I was an actor. I didn't even care about my dance classes, nor did I want to be a dancer. But so it was a very short-lived entry back into football when they heard that I was playing. And I was cut back out again from playing for after a year.
So that year of playing, this might be a loaded question because this is how I feel about it, but my sport was always rugby. I did play football a bit as a kid, and I kind of want to get back into it now, actually, because I don't play rugby anymore. But I really found... I started
Laces. I think see you on Thursday.
For me, when I started playing rugby at uni, that's when I first felt like I had found people that I connected with that were like me. So I wonder if you felt any, moving down to London, moving to a big city where you might not know a lot of people, I wonder if you found kind of friendship in that team as well, or people that you connected with.
It's probably a double question really, because it's also that sort of LGBTQ plus connection as well. To sport, so difficult, because I get asked this question all the time about why, as women in sport, it's so predominantly LGBTQ plus, and that's across amateur and elite. I like, really can't answer that question. Like, part of me wonders if it's because from such a young age we've had to force our way into spaces. So we feel almost like when we're coming out, it's just another thing that we've kind of like gone, you know what, this is who I am. Like, it's just a temperament and sort of people that we are, and that there are other people that maybe just not opened themselves up to that. You know, like, there's so many friends of mine that I think that would just never be welcome to the welcome to themselves to the fact that they could be LGBTQ plus. You know, and in the same vein, I've never played a stereotypical, in inverted commas, man's sport, you know, or rugby or football. And it maybe is that crossover. I can't put my finger on it. In terms of, I couldn't have had a really more paralleled experience to you. So when I didn't have any friends at drama school, there was a lot of gay men. There was a lot of straight girls. I was only, I was the only, now it's a different story, but at the time I was the only out woman in the entire college. And you knew everyone. It was a really sort of small environment. And there was a lot of jokes back then. It was really acceptable to kind of be, I think what would be now classed as quite homophobic.
Yeah.
And that'd be from teachers as well. And they'd kind of want you to be more closeted because it would really help with like getting jobs.
Yeah.
So there was that element as well. And then you go and play football. And that was like the first out women I'd met in my, in the air, in like the area, in the outskirts of London.
I think that that can sometimes give you the confidence if you're struggling with your own
sexuality. I was like so out though, but in a way that was like I wore it on my sleeve.
Yeah.
As in, I was so uncomfortable with it. And my approach to anything, in that's almost always my approach. You know how most people in nervousness will shy away. In nervousness, I over-talk. So with my sexuality, and when I was first kind of coming to terms with it, I hate that, but when I was first kind of coming out, I guess, I'd be so overtly gay. I'd like so like, I would say now unnecessarily, because it was like, I just wanted everyone to know. So it could be like, just get over it. This is who I am. Just get over it. Whereas actually it was like, now I kind of look back and I just want to give that girl a hug and be like, it's Helen and you're going to be all right, man. It's going to be fine. And also that the world has changed so much.
Yeah.
Like I work in my company now, with this like out people that are in their 20s or in like 18 to 20, they talk about their experiences, and I just cannot even fathom what it would feel like to just be able to come out at like 14. Like, it just rarely happened with our generation. It just didn't, it just wasn't a thing. And then going back even further, you know, talking to people like Lou Englefield from Football vs Homophobia, Pride Sports, who's an icon, her experiences, you know, a decade, two decades before that, it's just unfathomable. But in like 2005, 2006, around that sort of time, it was like you either shied away from it or something that you overtly were.
Yeah.
Like, it was like so out there, and that was really difficult. So I didn't really hide from it, but I don't think that I necessarily dealt with it very well. And then I go back to Newcastle and I wasn't really closeted, but like my family didn't know. They probably did, but my so I'd go, so I lived almost this double life. You could go back for Christmas, and then it would be an like actively remember not to talk about being gay. And then like I'd go into spaces with my mates on nights out and all the girls from school, and people knew I was out. So it'd either be like, in some scenarios I'd be like again this overtly gay person, other scenarios it'd be like, you know, in this completely different personality. And it's so damaging. It's so damaging.
A lot of people can probably relate to that, which is splitting yourself into two different people and being one person for your family and being one person in a different, maybe you're a different person at work, you're a different person in your social life.
And I remember my first job, my first proper job, office job, I came into the office and the girl sat next to me. It's all very funny, we laugh about it now, but it was like, Helen's partner, I think, was like mentioned early doors. My manager knew my girlfriend at the time, Helen's partner. And so people have been like, oh, when are we going to meet him? And that this was the kind of talk around the office. And it would be referenced. And I would just, in my head, remember to categorize it as like, don't say her, don't say she, because everybody's now like put my ex-girlfriend or my girlfriend at the time into this category. And I like, and I'm so scared to do the she bomb and say it's a girl that now I'm just going to just live in this camp of being straight. Oh my God. And I remember one day, Polly, my colleague, was like, Helen, you know what I've realized? You've been here for like 2 months. What's your boyfriend's name? And I was like, oh no. And it was that moment. And it was a name that you just couldn't, it was just not a boy's name.
Yeah.
And then just the whole room was like silent, and a couple of people knew and a couple of people didn't. And it was that coming out moment. I was like, I'm 22 and I'm coming out again.
Yeah.
And like, what? I just feel like I shouldn't have had to do this. And it's just so painfully awkward. And then it was really uncomfortable after that. And now I look back and I think,
I should have just said it from the beginning.
But it was like, you come out, I think, again and again and again and again and again.
Yeah.
Now as an adult, I guess I'm more in the public eye as well. But now as an adult, I can't remember the last time I came out.
Yeah.
Just kind of like, just doesn't feel like a thing anymore.
Yeah.
And I hope that's the same for 18-year-olds now in 2022, that they don't feel like they have to do that. But yeah, that's how it was.
So moving on a bit into your sort of career and your businesses, what came first? Was it Manchester Laces, Foudies?
Wow, technically Foudies came first. I was at the World Cup in 2019 over in France. And I was sat in the stadiums, and I was sort of traveling around, and I was seeing USA fans wearing shirts with no stars on them. I thought, but your women's team are your pride of the USA. Why are you wearing the men's shirts? Mm. And then I was seeing England fans with Beckham on the back, and I was thinking, you've traveled all the way to France. Why are you wearing Beckham shirts? Like, why not Lucy Bronze shirts? And basically talking to fans and being around fans and being a big part of that community and doing a podcast at the time as well about the women's World Cup, it became really clear that there was accessibility issues to these products, these official pieces of merchandise. So I quickly went on a hunt after the 2019 World Cup to try and get the rights to do the WSL lettering. So you could get like a Chelsea shirt, but you could add the WSL personalization on the back. And then I added sort of more and more things to it, doing the England shirts, USA shirts, and you name it. Now in the Euros, I was able to do the entire sort of Euros collection. And so after getting the rights, I launched in December 2020, and then I left my job in January 2021. So like a month after launching the business in my bedroom, I quickly realized this was going to be a really good idea. Mm-hmm. So in January 2021, I sort of went on this sort of mission launching Foudies and growing Foudies. And that coincided with coming out of lockdown. I remember thinking, we're coming out of lockdown, got this business in my bedroom, and there's a part of me that's so excited to get back on the football pitch, so excited to get back out there and be around, you know, women's footballers again and play 11-a-side football on a Sunday. But then there was this thing in the back of my mind where I was just dreading also going back into that 11-a-side culture that women's football has. So for anyone that doesn't play, you know, 11-a-side amateur football, I think a perfect anecdote would be like, I joined a team just before lockdown and I'd messaged them on Instagram, maybe got a one-liner back, train here, 7 o'clock, be there. You cross a patch of grass, maybe it's like getting quite dark, you're on your own with a pair of football boots and you approach a big group of women.
Yeah, I've been there many times with rugby.
Yeah, it's terrifying. And then in most football cultures, it's not because they're bad people, it's a fear of vulnerability. So people will go like, this is where you should be. And then they kind of like turn back to their mates. And then you're totally isolated.
Yeah.
And it can take weeks, if not months, for people to like know your name. It can take like weeks or months for people to like feel like you are part of the team. And then also I feel like there's an element of you have to prove yourself before you're welcomed. So you don't get a shot at being a striker, but they want you to score the goals. So you'd be like on the bench, you get 7 minutes at the end of a game, thinking this 7 minutes, I've got to score a hat trick to like try and integrate myself into this culture.
Or what I've experienced as well is kind of the flip side of that, which is if there's already an established team,
yeah,
and there's someone in that position and you come in and you're too good and you threaten them in their position, that can actually get quite political sometimes, yeah, and quite difficult.
I think that I don't know whether this is unique to women's football, and I couldn't tell you, but in amateur football, there is no club that should be run by a player. Mm. It, like, and when I say that, I don't mean what I do, which is administration. I mean, the coaches should have full control over the decision making, and the captains should be a support for the players. But almost every culture I've gone into in Manchester and like in other clubs in London and in Newcastle, what I've experienced is that the captain and some players have a control over who is playing where.
Team
sheets, and also just like someone they don't like. Mm-hmm. So we had a star player and they just didn't like her, so they just shoved her to right back out of position, almost the opposite position to what she should have been playing. And eventually she just left the club, moved two divisions higher and started in her key position. And I was just thinking, she could have been a star for us. She was a talisman, but she was never given the opportunity because she wasn't liked by the captain. And that essentially, that was the culture that was going back into after lockdown. So Foudies was going well. I was fully integrated into the women's football community. I was gathering a real good understanding of women's football fans and the scene. And I was already in it because I was a women's football fan myself and I was a player. And I just thought, something's got to give here. Manchester needs an environment where it's just driven by a really strong ethos of kindness. I just really felt it. I just felt like it needed to happen. So I contacted Katie Huey, who runs Hackney Laces. They're an iconic football team who support young women in the community with free football sessions. They support things like, they give them Wi-Fi for their homes. They're like, it's not just a football club. It's their whole ethos is around, you know, Laces tie us together. We are a community, and they are huge in Hackney. They're a Nike London partner. They're on billboards around the city. And Katie was like, we will help you to make this happen. So in the beginning, it was dead easy. So we just basically lifted the Hackney design, chose yellow because of the Manchester Bees and, you know, the culture within this city, yeah, of worker bees and the culture of the people around the city. And then I built my own ethos and my own sort of culture around it. And that was in the March, just before lockdown ended. And we launched on the end of March and I just couldn't believe it. We launched it at Wally Range, which is our home, sort of our home centre. And we had like 50, 60 people turn up on week one. Pensioners, 18-year-olds, people that were transgender, people that were Somalian that had come in and just been like, I heard there was a safe space for me to play football. I couldn't believe it. Like, honestly, I don't think I've told anyone, but I remember getting in the car with my wife and just being like, so emotional.
Yeah.
I just couldn't believe it. I just thought,
it's
happened.
That would have been incredible timing for people as well, because there will be so many people who were so lonely at that time,
yeah,
and needed just to get out and to meet new people and like the social side of it as well.
I stood at the end and I just remember talking, like, I brought in some mates to like help make it happen, and they're still part of the leadership now 18 months later. And I said before we started, I said, we have to be like the cheesiest, nicest, like over the top people today. And I know it's not comfortable, but by doing that, like by being, I'm allowed to swear.
Yeah.
By being like the biggest dick in the room, like by being the one that's like, hey, like everyone will feel more comfortable.
Yeah.
And so all of us were there just being like, come on in. It was like almost too much. And I just wanted to be the absolute polar opposite from that girl a year earlier, walking across a patch of grass and going, hi, am I in the right place? Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I just wanted to create the absolute opposite environment. And now we are the biggest club in Manchester by far for women's football. We have over 500 participants. We have 120 full members, 5 squads. And we are the only still kind of driven, inclusive space. And what that means to me is, if you come to me, we will move our goalposts around you and your needs and what that means to you. Mm-hmm. So I want to say that they kind of coincided with each other. Foudies allowed Manchester Laces to happen, and Manchester Laces is sort of the backbone, or is a major sort of key to allowing Foudies to grow and thrive as well. Like, I'd be lying if I said there wasn't that sort of intrinsic connection, but I guess that's me because it's cut me in half and I'm in Foudies and Manchester Laces. Yeah.
So I do want to talk a little bit about like the trans exclusion in sport. So what's the FA's view on that?
Be careful, Helen. The FA policy still at this stage is really gender specific. Like, I think we've entered a world as a society where we recognise that there is fluidity in terms of gender. And I think that sports are really struggling to come to terms with that.
Yeah.
So the policy very much states that you are in a women's league or you're in a men's league. Now, like, I'm going to give you a real example. This is in the last few days that's happened. And obviously, for obvious reasons, I don't want to name names. We have a player that plays with us, that has been with us since the beginning on our Monday night sessions. Our Monday night sessions are ad hoc, so you just sign on and play. And that's why we have such a huge sort of network of players. And the reason we launched that is for, you know, mums that might have childcare issues one week but want to play the next week. So we want to create that flexibility. And this player was born as a woman and now identifies as non-binary. But has had top surgery and has had testosterone. Mm-hmm. So this player plays with us on a Monday, spoke to me about a month ago, was like, I want to come to your membership sessions. The membership sessions like lead you towards playing 11-a-side football, lead you towards playing in what's called the Flexi League, which is like casual football, but against oppositions. And so I'm like, yeah. So what does your passport say out of interest? And they said, my passport is still my original passport, so I'm a female on it. Now, when you add a player to the FA system, you put their ID in. So you have to do a driving license or a passport. Within the driving license, it doesn't have your gender written onto it, but within the detailing, it does. You wouldn't realise it, but it does actually have your gender written into it, which is really annoying. So you put that into the system. It says, right, there's an F there on the passport. You are a female. Bish, bash, bosh, off you go. Mm-hmm. So I submitted this player and that's fine. I then contacted the FA for support to ensure the safety of this player, as obviously they are on a journey now, and to ensure when we met oppositions that there was going to be sort of security and stability for that player playing with us. It's also worth noting that player doesn't play in our top squad. There's no physical difference. Yeah. I'm sure they wouldn't mind me saying I'd kick their ass on a football field. So it's nothing to do with that. And then immediately the FA pulled that player from our system. So they took the player out of our system once we confronted them about support, the support we wanted for this player. My question is, and has always been, where does this player play? Can this player play for a men's team? No, because when they put their passport in, it will have the little F, and the little F will assign them to a women's team. Can they play for a women's team? No, because you've decided that there are some barriers, I don't know what it is, and I don't even want to try and guess what it is, to playing in the women's team. So an organisation whose very tagline is football for all is cutting out this specific player. And this isn't just one person. This isn't just like a one-off example. And so what they say, the FA, or what the next stage would be, the natural next stage, would be that this player would then submit hormone readings to ensure that they are within a certain spectrum, which isn't actually outlined or shown in guidance to what that is. It's a finger in the air. Mm-hmm. And then that's what will decipher where that player plays. So I said to the FA, that's absolutely fine. However, we are an inclusive space. It's written into our ethos. So if one player doesn't play, we all don't play. And if one player has to do hormone readings, we all have to do hormone readings. So I'm due on my period next week and my hormones are going to be all over the place. So I expect my hormones will probably be up. Yeah. That person's will probably be down. That person's might be evened out. So their expectation is to spend that money on that player going for regular hormone readings, which, by the way, isn't just like an at-home test. You go to your doctor, You submit the readings. You have to wait for the answer to whether you can play on that Sunday.
And for what? Is their view that they would have a slightly increased level of testosterone, which therefore puts everyone else at a disadvantage? Is that what they're assuming?
You'd have to ask the FA. Yeah. Like, I think you were perfect when you said, and for what?
Yeah.
I think, like, this is it. It's a finger in the air. I don't think we have real clarity. And if there is clarity out there, it's not done in a supportive way.
No.
So, like, with this specific incident that is literally right now active, so this has been yesterday, me in an email chain with various groups of people, nobody yet has supported me as a club founder on how I can support this person. Yeah. The only support they're getting is from us as a club. And I'm not an expert.
Yeah.
I'm not an expert.
Yeah.
I'm just a normal person who just wants to offer football for all people. And the other thing is that, so like, and I'm, by the way, I'm not correlating any of this to what I've just said, and I just don't want this to be taken out of context. I am willing to signpost people. So we have had players come to us that are severely autistic on the spectrum, and they are welcome to play at Manchester Laces. Of course they are. For them, there may be better spaces for them to play at, and those places may exist. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they don't, frankly, and we need to improve, you know, our offering for disabled football players. And that's something probably Manchester Laces will end up doing, because I get annoyed at things and then I just make them happen. But that we may be able to signpost them. If a gay man was to come to play for me, I can signpost them to a fantastic environment for that person.
Yeah.
If somebody that's non-binary was to come play for us, there may be a more suitable environment that I can signpost that player to go and play for,
yeah,
than Manchester Laces. I cannot signpost this player to another club. They are not safe even in LGBTQ+ men's clubs. They are not safe in standard men's clubs. They're not really even safe in standard women's clubs.
Yeah.
Where would I signpost this player? Like, this is my argument to the FA. And I have, like, verbatim heard an FA person say, well, they just wouldn't be able to play right now. Like, this is the difficulty, is that I'm not trying to be somebody that's like, like pitchforks at dawn. I'm just trying to answer a really simple question, which is, like, I have players that feel safe in my environment. They are safe for my players in my environment, because my priority is the safety of all my players. And therefore, what would be your expectation of me? What do you want me to do? Like, turn them away and say, sorry, you can't play football anywhere. Like, that's where this comes down to. Let's take out all of our thoughts on trans issues. This isn't what this is about. It's about football for all,
and everyone having the opportunity.
Opportunity to play in a safe environment, and this is a safe environment for a lot of players.
Yeah.
So that's it. There's nothing else to it. On the other side, we obviously have a lot of trans women that come and play for us, and it's a similar thing. It goes back to a point I spoke about a little while ago. I play for a club called Rover and Out, a five-a-side men's team. I love it. Some people wouldn't love it. There's a lot of women that would be like, that for me would be quite a daunting environment. I love it. Like, at amateur level, the difference in correlation in terms of ability is so small. We paint this picture of, like, and I think there's this lie about USA women's team losing to an under 15 boys team. It's a lie. It's just an outright lie. And, like, this has been from the mouth of USA players. Factually, they did a what was called a scrummage, I think, in American culture, which is where you play like training stuff, and someone would have a shot on goal on Hope Solo or whatever it was, and that's what it was. But I think that this is the sort of culture of men and women can't play together because it's so freaking dangerous for women. And, like, please don't patronize me. I've spoken to a lot of, like, American football fans about how I'm, like, the only person on earth that plays on this sort of men's football team, and they've been like, honestly, it's really difficult to come across women only soccer teams over here. Like, right. It's really difficult to, like, find 11-a-side soccer women's team. It would be standard place to go and play soccer mixed gender. And that's similar in other cultures, like, I want to say in Iceland and Finland and other places across Europe, mixed gender would, like, it's just not even a thing. It's like just a thick, like, it's a standard, like, you'd go to football practice as an adult in your 30s and you'd just be mixed gender.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a thing.
I think we're a bit obsessed with it over here.
We're obsessed with it. We're obsessed with it. Like, my dad's like, hey, pet, I worry about you going to play with the lads. And I'm like, it's so patronising.
Yeah.
So patronising, because for every, like, tackle that I'm dodging, or for every sort of physical one-on-one, my passing is so much better than almost every man that I play with. Like, I sound like well cocky, but it's just like, in terms of, like, if you're lining up all of the attributes of a footballer, there's areas where I'm nuanced and better, there's areas where they're nuanced and better, and I just would never get in a foot race with a man, because I'd be like, I'll lose that. So all I'll do is, like, I'll position my body differently. Yeah. Like, I'll just play a different type of game to challenge them, to be a one-on-one with them.
And we're also kind of ignoring the fact that all of this is optional for people.
Yeah.
Like, if I want to go and play on a men's team, that's my choice.
Yeah, totally.
And if I want to stop, I'll stop. Like, we need to give people the option.
Yeah, I think as a culture, we are more gender obsessed than in sport than a lot of other cultures.
Yeah.
And we need to wake up to that.
Yeah.
So to come back to it, and I feel like it's really important to categorically say that trans women are women.
Yeah.
And that's not the point I'm making. I'm just saying that if a trans woman comes to my club, I am a safe environment for them to play in, where there is no judgment, where our ethos is built on welcoming all people from all communities in Manchester, and where the FA should recognise that this is the best environment for them to play in competitively, and where they will be the safest and oppositions will be the safest.
Let's talk about the Euros. What impact has that had on you? What impact has that had on your shirt sales and the engagement with you on social media, the number of people that you've got showing up to practice? I'm sure it's just had a hugely positive impact.
I think from the quarterfinal onwards, we started to see that change. So at Manchester Laces, we increased participation by almost double now. So in terms of new players coming in, and then there's also the fact that regardless of what's happening in terms of England's success, you're going to see a peak anyway. So my prediction was that we would see, if England, I'm a marketeer by trade, so I do get a bit obsessed with future proofing. So I did say to the leadership team at Manchester Laces, if we get to the quarterfinal, I predict we'll get 20 extra players. If we get to the semi-final, I think we're probably looking at 30. And if we get to the final and win, or the final and lose, I think we'll be looking at 40 plus. We've looked at around, in our membership sessions, around 50 to 60 new players. And in our club overall, around 150 new people have come through the door. So after the quarterfinal, I remember standing on the pitch and asking people to raise their hands and said, are you here because you've kind of got into the football over the last few weeks? I'd say 50 to 60% of people raised their hands,
yeah,
saying, like, this Euros tournament, I don't want to put that on England necessarily, has inspired me to be here. Because it's not just England, it's all the countries that took part. There was a lot of people that became kind of sort of spotlighted, I think, as a result of the tournament. Like the Spanish women's team, I think, have really bolstered, even though they went out the quarters. I think Germany, obviously, it's done wonders for them, especially Alex Pop.
Yeah.
And I think there's so many stories surrounding other teams. But my goodness, the Lionesses, what they've done for women in general, outside of sport, in sport, future generations, past generations, I don't think is actually conceivable. I don't think that Chloe Kelly, or the younger players in particular, can physically realise. I don't think they would be able to realise what they've done. Like, I don't think that it's could be within the realms of them understanding. From a Jill Scott perspective, I think she gets it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you read her retirement piece about driving over from Sunderland to Everton, pretending to do interviews in her car as if one day she was going to be famous. Is even making me quite emotional right now. Like, I think those players get it. They get the impact. They're seeing it. I think for the younger players, they've never really known any different. And they've seen, to go from 80 to 100, it's slightly different from going from 0 to 100. for the Jill Scotts and the Lucy Bronzes of this world. But it's been amazing. It's been amazing. We have tons of investors sniffing around from a business perspective. Shirt sales have, of course, gone up. Yeah. We started to look at like really niche products from a Foudy's perspective. Like we did a Jill Scott t-shirt, which is FOYFP. Fuck off, you fucking prick. I know I'm allowed to swear now. You can bleep that if you want. And which was the most sold product we've ever had on the Foudy's website. Everybody gets it now. Like I would know little niche moments. Like a couple of years ago, Marta, a Brazilian icon, pulled out a corner flag, and in a moment of anger, like this for me would be like something that now I think would be headline, you know, be something where you'd see it on Twitter and it would be trending. As a couple of years ago, even though she's an iconic women's player, it just was like a niche little thing, like a women's football in joke. Now, Jill Scott goes, fuck off, you fucking prick, in a European final, and it's a meme.
And like, the shirt off around the head.
The shirt off around the head.
So many iconic moments.
The shirt off around the head is now tattooed on my leg.
Is it?
And my parents are furious. Still, we're not really talking about it. But for a moment in time, the Chloe Kelly shirt off around her head moment, I was at Wembley with my family. And my dad's got so into women's football over the years. I'd like to say or thank him for sort of introducing me to it. And he was like, told me when I was younger about Kelly Smith, like never seen what she looked like or anything, but I knew this woman existed and that she'd gone to America to like seek her fortune as a footballer. And maybe there was a route into football and, oh, that's so exciting. And I remember my dad sort of was really for it. He really like wanted to champion women's football. It was just impossible to do so for so many years. And so he followed the 2015 World Cup, watching it at 2 o'clock in the morning with me in, you know, the Canada World Cup. 2019, he was proper into it. He'd try and raise conversations in the pub with his mates, not really get anywhere. And then now, obviously, we're stood at a Wembley final. And it was my dad that was the first one to lean in, and he went, Brandy Chastain. And of course, in 1999, it's been noted as being the most iconic image of a woman sports person of all time. Brandy Chastain ripped her top off, happened to have a white sports bra on, and she slid on her knees when USA won the Women's World Cup. I don't know whether Chloe Kelly realised what that was. That was USA's changing of the water. That was the moment where the tide changed for the USA. They'd had a thing called Title IX, which came in, which meant that there was equality for women going into college schemes and getting sporting scholarships. And then the outcome was, in 1999, USA won the World Cup. And that was, it was like that moment where USA went, we're going to take this seriously now. 90,000 people in the Florida Bowl watching us lift a World Cup. My God, let's actually pump money into this. And, you know, 3 World Cups later, and they've got 4 World Cups, 16 major honours, Olympic gold after Olympic gold. That was USA's moment in 1999, where you really saw the change.
Yeah.
Our moment was at Wembley on the 31st of July, 2022. 80,000 people sold out. It was unbelievable. And Chloe Kelly ripping her top off, it was like a parallel moment. You just went like, this is our USA moment.
Yeah.
And then what does that mean? Like 1999 to now, For England, in 20 years, we're going to have 16 major honours, World Cup titles. I think we can win the World Cup next year. I really do. And I'm getting shivers thinking about it. But also what that impacts in terms of little girls in the future. And I don't think Chloe Kelly knows. I don't think she can fathom it, because A, she's in the bubble. So she's in this world. B, she's so young. And like, she's not known what it was like to be in 1996 at Forest Hall Girls Club, where you were playing Sunderland and losing 26-0.
Yeah.
Like, there was academies introduced when she was kind of going through those systems. She is the change. Like, she is part of what we've seen as the change for women's football culture. So it's now on my leg forever, because for me, it was just such an iconic image of like, this is the start of our change for England as a nation and for women as a whole.
Yeah.
You know, what little girl now can say, you know, I can't be a footballer. You can't.
And they'll get that on TV. Parental support as well, because parents will be thinking, well, it could actually be a career now.
It can be a career.
Like, same way it could be for my son.
Yeah. And then I think also, people want to enclose this into football, but it's so much more than football. Because if you can be a footballer, a man's sport, if she can be a footballer, why can't she be a CEO?
Yeah.
Like, if she can be a footballer, why can't she be a rugby player or a cricket player? Like, why can't she be a surgeon or an astronaut? Like, I think that we forget, because people want to make football into like a small part of our culture. It's not. Mm-hmm. Football is so much more than what happens on the pitch. It's so all encompassing. It's the very fabric of the DNA of our society. And it goes back to obviously the recent events with the royal family. The reason why football was cancelled is because it's our national sport, and Prince William is one of the heads of the FA. It's a mark of a sign of respect that this is our national sport. Yeah. So like, I think seeing our women bring it home when our men haven't been able to do it, I think it's a real symbol for the future for women in this culture, in this society.
So what's next then? People who might listen to this and want to show that support, is it buying tickets and showing up for the games?
Yeah, I think it's domestic level is going to be huge, but we're already seeing that change. So we've seen sold out season tickets for Chelsea, various other clubs in the WSL. I think we need to start engaging more with Europe in terms of domestically. And there's some amazing European teams. These English teams aren't the best teams in the world. The best teams in the world are Lyon, Barcelona. Mm-hmm. We're starting to see teams like Juventus come through. So it'd be great to start to see people not just engaging in our domestic league, but seeing that travel as well, seeing people wanting to see it all over the world. And the atmosphere is amazing. I was at the Nou Camp for this 90,000 Barcelona Real Madrid women's game in March. And in terms of tribalism to sport, I've never known anything like it. And I swear, I follow Newcastle United. I've gone everywhere. I've gone to all the men's games. I've been to watch Messi Barcelona, the men's Barcelona games when they were like Champions League contenders. It was like no atmosphere I've ever experienced. Like, the stadium was shaking because this women's team have like completely enthralled the Barcelona community to the point they're selling out stadiums easy. Like, it's not even a thing anymore. 25,000 going to watch their women's team, these superstar women. So it'd be great to see that shift over in terms of like our interest, like being not just sort of Saturday morning, but Wednesday night in the Champions League. And we're starting to see that culture like shift from just not just England superstars, but across the board. I'd love to see that, and that will help to grow the women's game even more.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I will be ordering a Lucy Bronze t-shirt.
Yes.
From Foudies, and I will probably be showing up to Manchester Laces next week.
Oh, love it. Well, just as a like sort of embarrassing story, Lucy Bronze, my favourite player, I printed myself a Lucy Bronze number 2 shirt. And then she randomly is a number 15. So if you want a number 2 bronze shirt, it's going free.
Thank you very much.
No worries.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and leave a rating and a review to help us get seen by more people. If you can, please follow us on social media by clicking the links in our podcast description.